On the show today, the U.S. strikes back at Iran-backed militants.
And U.S. Central Command says retaliatory strikes were carried out early Tuesday in Iraq.
Plus, Ukraine strikes back at Russia.
Ukrainian Air Force spokesperson Yuri Ignat confirms the destruction of a large amphibious ship of the Black Sea Fleet of the Russian Federation. The ship was destroyed by the Ukrainian Air Force using tactical aviation cruise missiles in Feodosia in occupied Crimea.
And later, a look at the widening conflict in the Middle East and the role of media outlets and journalists in an age of misinformation in politics. Today is Tuesday, December 26th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. President Joe Biden has ordered retaliatory airstrikes against Iranian-backed militia groups after three American service members were injured in a drone attack in northern Iraq on Monday. The Iranian-backed militia, Kataib Hezbollah, and affiliated groups under an umbrella of Iranian-backed militants claimed credit for the attack. Biden, who is spending Christmas at the presidential retreat at Camp David in Maryland, was briefed on the attack on Monday and ordered the response. The AP's Donna Warder reports.
President Joe Biden ordered the U.S. military to carry out retaliatory airstrikes against Iranian-backed militia groups who claimed responsibility for Monday's attack. National Security Council spokeswoman Adrienne Wilson says one of the U.S. service members sustained critical injuries. Biden, who's spending Christmas at Camp David, was told about the attack by White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan shortly after it occurred. And the Pentagon and Biden's top national security aides were ordered to prepare response options to the attack on an airbase used by American troops. Biden opted to target three locations used by the militia groups, and U.S. Central Command says retaliatory strikes were carried out early Tuesday in Iraq and likely killed a number of militants. Donna Warder, Washington.
For its part, Baghdad has condemned the attacks, calling them a hostile act as regional tensions surge amid the Israel-Hamas war. Fears of a widening conflict continue to grow on Tuesday. In India, New Delhi police are investigating a reported blast near the Israeli embassy there. Israeli officials say they're cooperating with their Indian counterparts and say that an investigation is underway. All this as Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant hinted that Israel has already retaliated against foes in Iraq, Yemen, and Iran for attacks carried out against it as the war with Hamas-led Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip widens to other areas of the region.
We are in a multi-front war and are coming under attack from seven different theaters: Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, Judea and Samaria, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran. We have already responded and taken action in six of these theaters. And I say here in the most explicit way, anyone who acts against us is a potential target. There is no immunity for anyone.
Since the October 7th attack on Israel by Hamas, the Israeli military has said it also retaliated for attacks from Lebanon and Syria and carried out raids on Palestinian militants in the occupied West Bank. It has not publicly revealed such actions in Yemen, whose Iran-aligned Houthis have carried out long-range missile and drone launches at Israel and attacked shipping in the Red Sea, nor Iraq, where a pro-Iran militia said last week it had fired a drone at the southern Israeli port city of Eilat. And meanwhile, in Syria, a senior Iranian general from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard was assassinated in an Israeli airstrike near Damascus. Brigadier General Saeed Razi Mazouvi was in Syria as an advisor to Hezbollah, the Iran-backed anti-Israel militant group. The Iranian Defense Ministry said on Tuesday that their response to the assassination of a high-ranking general would be, quote, smart and strong. Heading north of Israel to the conflict in Ukraine, Ukrainian forces scored a victory in the waters off Crimea as they attacked and destroyed a Russian ship that early, though unconfirmed reports say, was carrying Iranian-made drones. The AP's Karen Chamas reports.
Russia has said that Ukrainian forces have damaged one of its naval ships in Crimea. The landing ship was hit at a base in the city of Feodosia by plane-launched guided missiles, according to Russia's defense ministry. The ministry added that two Ukrainian fighter jets were destroyed by anti-aircraft fire during the attack. Over the past several months, Ukrainian forces have conducted attacks around Crimea, mostly with sea drones. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, says the attacks helped to restore navigation in the Black Sea, which in turn would allow the export of millions of tons of grain. I'm Karen Chamas.
As we've just heard, the Ukrainian Air Force destroyed a Russian amphibious ship in occupied Crimea. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian parliament is set to discuss a draft law on improving mobilization strategy and military records. VOA's correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details.
Ukrainian Air Force spokesperson Yuri Ignat confirmed the destruction of a large amphibious ship of the Black Sea Fleet of the Russian Federation. The ship was destroyed by the Ukrainian Air Force using tactical aviation cruise missiles in Feodosia in occupied Crimea. Yuri Ignat said, "The attack was conducted by the Air Force's tactical aviation pilots. The operation was planned by the armed forces and other structures. Now the stunning footage appears showing that the ship has been destroyed, probably with ammunition, a powerful ammunition kit. A powerful work has been done. A large amphibious assault ship was destroyed and it replenishes the fleet that is now headed by the guided missile cruiser Moskva." Russian officials also confirmed the attack. According to the Interfax media outlet, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu has already reported to Vladimir Putin about the Ukrainian attack on Feodosia and the damage to the ship. Meanwhile, on Monday, the Cabinet of Ministers of Ukraine submitted to the Ukrainian Parliament a draft law on improving mobilization strategy and military record. According to preliminary information, the law may include the following: lowering the minimum age at which conscripted soldiers can be sent into battle, improvement of the procedure for military registration, introduction of basic military training for citizens of Ukraine for up to 3 months for all citizens aged 18 to 25 at all educational institutions, restrictions on the rights of Ukrainian citizens who evade military registration and military service, and more. This is still only a preliminary version of the law, so it is likely to be changed before it finally gets approved. VOA will follow the developments and the implementation of the new law once it is passed. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We take a look at the role of the media in a moment, but now we look back on 2023 and Russia's war in Ukraine. Ukrainian forces attempted to break through the lines of invading Russians as the West stepped up the supply of heavier weapons and advanced missile systems. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, neither side appears to be able to make a significant breakthrough. And there is little sign that Kyiv or Moscow are prepared to negotiate a peace deal.
Invading Russian forces seized the Ukrainian salt mining town of Soledar in January 2023 after months of brutal fighting. Russian missiles continued to rain down on Ukrainian cities. With Ukrainian forces struggling to make battlefield gains, Western allies announced they would send heavy weapons to Kyiv, including tanks and longer-range missile systems. Ahead of the first anniversary of the war in February, US President Joe Biden made an unannounced visit to Kyiv. He said Russian President Vladimir Putin had been wrong about Western commitment to Ukraine.
He thought he could outlast us. I don't think he's thinking that right now.
Evidence suggests that Russia destroyed the Novokakhovka Dam in May, flooding vast areas of southeast Ukraine to stall any Ukrainian counteroffensive and creating an environmental disaster. Russia, in return, blamed Ukraine for the structure's collapse. By June, Ukraine was able to recapture some territory, but failed to achieve a major breakthrough in the Russian lines. The Western weapons supplies were too little, too late, says analyst Ian Bond.
The Russians had a long time to build up their minefields and their fixed fortifications. So they're actually in a much stronger position than they were. And we've been asking the Ukrainians to launch their counteroffensive when they have very little air capability.
Mercenaries from Russia's private Wagner army staged a mutiny in June. Putin negotiated an end to the rebellion. Wagner's chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin, was killed in a plane crash a few weeks later. By November, Ukraine's commander-in-chief said the war had reached a stalemate, though Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, disagreed with his assessment. Zelensky did achieve a diplomatic breakthrough, as the European Union, in December, agreed to start formal accession talks.
The negotiation process will not be easy, but the main thing is that historically we have made a determination. Ukraine will always be part of our common European home.
But that European future remains in the balance, says analyst Olga Tokariuk.
If Ukraine is defeated, if Ukraine fails militarily, all the, you know, EU membership negotiations process is worthless. But it will not just be a defeat of Ukraine, it will be a defeat of European Union and the wider West that committed to supporting Ukraine as long as it takes.
Ukrainian forces face a long, bitter winter on the front lines, with vital military aid packages held up in both the United States and the European Union. Analysts say Ukraine's greatest concern for the coming year is Western fatigue, as the US presidential election looms at the end of 2024. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
Following Fox News' stunning settlement for $787.5 million with Dominion Voting Systems, we look at the role of the news media in preventing, or sometimes perpetrating, misinformation. I speak with writer and former host of CNN's Reliable Sources, Brian Stelter.
America famously has freedom of the press, freedom of speech. What line did Fox cross where it broke a law?
This very, very high bar set by the Supreme Court, many decades ago, in the case called New York Times v. Sullivan, describes actual malice. And that's the standard for a public figure to allege defamation. Actual malice means you either knew it was false and you said it anyway, or you had reckless disregard for the truth. And Dominion, this voting machines company, had a very strong case that Fox had, in fact, committed actual malice. That's why Rupert and Lachlan Murdoch, the men who control Fox, decided to settle out of court and not go through the pain of a jury trial that they might well have lost. It's because Fox hosts and guests were on the air repeatedly smearing Dominion, claiming that the voting machines were rigged, claiming that the election was rigged against Trump. And frankly, there was just such a body of evidence, such a volume to it, that suggested Fox executives and stars knew the truth, but were repeating these claims, letting these claims be repeated on the air anyway. Here's how I would frame the freedom of speech issue. Media owners like the Murdochs, they must not intervene or meddle in real reporting. They must let journalists do their jobs. But when there are lies being spread on the air, that's an entirely different matter.
Now, I think why so many find this whole episode so offensive is that the media is supposed to combat misinformation, not be the source of misinformation. How is the network going to go on from this?
Yeah, the way I see it in this media environment these days, there's a big bright line between places that are flawed but trying to get it right versus places that don't care and are just out to score points, to advance a political agenda, to elect certain candidates, to destroy other candidates. And certainly there are some Fox shows that just don't care. Sean Hannity, for one, he makes it his life's work to defeat Democrats and win elections for Republicans. And I think most of his viewers know that. I don't think he hides what he is trying to do. The issue I think we face as a country is that a lot of people prefer that version of what he's doing, that talk show version, that propaganda version, over the real reporting that happens elsewhere. And frankly, it comes down to a kind of question about media diets or what's most nutritious. It's a lot more nutritious to actually consume a well-balanced media diet, getting a wide variety of sources of news. But frankly, there's a decent number of people in the country that prefer what Sean Hannity does instead. Where does the network go from here? Well, I think we're going to see more of the same in 2024. But there are many people, Republicans, Democrats, media critics, shareholders of Fox, who are watching to see if Fox is reality-based, if it reports the facts about the next election, or if it descends down a rabbit hole and promotes whatever Trump wants them to promote. That's going to be, you know, a giant test for Fox and other media outlets in 2024.
So how do news outlets give bad news to people without losing their audience?
I think that's a really interesting and really challenging question. There's obviously a great long history of aggressive adversarial journalism in the United States, investigative journalism, in-depth journalism. I feel like now it's the best of times, worst of times. You know, we live in an age where there's so much trash, but there's also so much treasure. And all of the pressure is put on the consumer, on the reader, on the viewer, to be able to sort out the difference, to be able to know the difference. When you're scrolling through a Facebook feed or an X feed, you're seeing really rigorous reporting right next to somebody's blog, right next to somebody's disinformation campaign. And it can be incredibly confusing for people, I think, for average Americans to know the difference. But in this environment, you know, I guess I look at it and I say it's, you know, like I said, it's the best of times, worst of times. But, you know, that said, we see through subscriptions, through the launch of startups, a very vibrant news culture in the United States that is beyond the hyper-partisan echo chambers that we're all aware of. That's what's most important, right, is to be able to break out beyond the political arguments and get to real reporting, both locally, nationally, internationally.
Well, going to the responsibility of journalists, Oliver Wendell Holmes' idea of the marketplace of ideas, right, necessary for democracy. But what happens when some of the players in that marketplace are fascists, are mentally ill, are crooks, and are being enabled by media outlets? How can normal reporters, regular journalists, compete with that?
Right. Well, you know, it's that old saying about the lie getting halfway around the world before the truth can have a fighting chance. But I tend not to buy that for the following reason. When I look at the results of recent elections in the United States, for example, I see that even though there's propaganda outlets out there, even though there are social media war, you know, campaigns going on trying to confuse people, even though there's so much chaos in the information environment, we are seeing, you know, like time and time again, people seeking out moderates, people seeking out reality-based politicians, people seeking out responsible lawmakers. Now, of course, not in every case, not in every district, not every time. But I find when I look at results of elections, when I see trends about subscriptions to places like the New York Times, I see that there are lots and lots of people that are seeking out reality-based and, you know, and responsible both reporting and also politicians. Maybe it's the holiday season that's making me try to be cheerful, but I see some positive signs out there. At the same time, as you acknowledged, it is an information environment that is chaotic, that is prone to bad faith actors, where you have propagandists who trying to control media outlets. You know, take for example Donald Trump and how he uses Truth Social to push anything but the truth. That's a real challenge in a fragmenting media environment where people can again choose their own reality. But if you look at how popular his social network is versus something like Facebook and TikTok, Trump's doesn't stand a chance. In fact, it's losing money and it may fall apart as a business. So that suggests to me that the trend lines are not entirely in favor of disinformation, but that the truth still has a fighting chance.
Brian Stelter is the former host of CNN's Reliable Sources. His latest book is called Network of Lies. He was speaking to me from VOA's New York Bureau. Healthcare and access to it is a crisis many people in the world face. Our next story shows us some of the extraordinary lengths some doctors are going through to help people waiting for organ transplants. Xenotransplantation is the process of transferring animal organs into humans. However, in the United States, the procedure is only allowed for patients with serious or life-threatening conditions. Johnny Fernandez reports from New York City.
Pioneering heart transplant surgeon Dr. Robert Montgomery has a passion for his work, which stems from his own battle with heart disease.
I had to have 7 cardiac arrests and almost die before I could even qualify to be listed for a transplant. Because once you're put on the list, you know, you have to be so sick in order to actually have an organ allocated to you.
In 2018, he received a new heart and a chance to continue his work towards solving the worldwide organ shortage through xenotransplantation, a process of replacing human organs or tissues with animal ones. Pigs are primarily used, and their genes are edited to lower the risk of rejection after the transplant.
So many people die even before they get listed, and then when they get listed in the United States for a transplant, only a third of the people will actually receive a transplant that are on the list. The other two-thirds either get too sick to benefit from a transplant or die.
After his heart transplant, Montgomery, who now heads the New York University Langone Transplant Institute in New York City, focused on studying the impacts of xenotransplantation on the human body. In 2022, the Capuano family became a part of Montgomery's research program after Alva Capuano suffered irreversible brain damage. Her family donated Capuano's body to xenotransplantation trials. As her son Tim Capuano explains, contributing to medical research has been one of her final wishes.
We've always known that it was important to my mom, Alva.
Alva Capuano received a pig's heart and lived with it for 3 days. In 2023, Montgomery and his team performed a historic pig kidney transplant on a man whose body functioned with it for 2 months and didn't reject the animal organ. He says this is just a start to finding a solution to a worldwide problem.
This is one step forward, you know, for a solution to the organ shortage worldwide. I think then the next steps are to, you know, accomplish those trials in living humans and demonstrate that these kidneys last for a period of time where the person benefits from it.
Either a kidney or a heart, Montgomery says he'll continue to push to find a solution to a growing global problem he was lucky enough to live through. Johnny Fernandez, VOA News, New York.
And finally today, more on the crisis of accessing healthcare. A new mobile clinic is providing much-needed medical services in northeast Syria and promoting awareness of female-related health issues in the war-torn country. VOA's Hiro Mitani has the story from Derik, Syria, narrated for us today by Sirwan Kejo.
When it arrives in small villages like this one in northeast Syria, the mobile clinic quickly bustles with activity. Launched by a local women's group, the new project also aims to educate women in the countryside about female-related health issues.
The mobile clinic has 3 staff members, a doctor, a nurse, and a driver. The clinic is particularly useful for women because the services that we provide are mostly for female-related health issues.
In a country whose healthcare infrastructure has largely been destroyed due to a decade-long conflict, a mobile clinic is particularly useful for residents in Syria's countryside.
We are grateful for this clinic. They visit us and other villages. We really hope that they can expand their operation. Because we are far away from cities and we don't have cars and medical centers, people are poor here. Sometimes they cannot even buy their medication.
According to the UN, more than 2.5 million internally displaced people live in northeast Syria. The mobile clinic has been making the rounds for about 2 months and has already seen about 1,000 women in the region. Local healthcare workers and residents are pushing for more mobile clinics to meet the demand for medical care in the region. For Jiro Mitani and Derik, Syria, Sirwan Kejo, VOA News.
And that's going to end today's show. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.